From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. And House Democrats today made a choice to keep Nancy Pelosi of California as their leader. She beat back a challenge from Congressman Tim Ryan of Ohio to be the minority leader in the House. The final vote tally was 134 for Pelosi, 63 for Ryan. Here's Representative Marcia Fudge at a press briefing earlier this afternoon. Fudge was supporting Ryan.
One-third of the members of this caucus had the courage to come out and say we needed a change. And I congratulate all of them. And for those who voted for our leader, I think that's great. I think she's a wonderful leader. But what I do know is when I go home, people are going to ask me, what did you do to make this better? Doing nothing doesn't make it better. But today, we won because they hear us.
Well, joining us now is NPR Senior Washington Editor and Correspondent Ron Elving. Hi, Ron.
Hello, Jeremy.
And Nancy Pelosi had said before the vote that she had the support of two-thirds of her colleagues. She almost hit that number exactly. But 63 Democrats voting against her, it's not a small number. What does it tell you about the state of the Democratic Party?
She exceeded her two-thirds target just by a little bit, but she was probably building in a little bit of leeway when she set that target. It's not a bad number, though. 63 votes for Tim Ryan. No one thought he had any realistic chance of winning. So you've got a third of the people who are willing to step out and say, time for a change. That is a clear signal to Nancy Pelosi. She needs to see that the time is coming and perhaps is quite near at hand. So let's say 2018, if they don't gain back enough seats to be in the majority, no one expects that. The map doesn't really permit it. It's not practical. So at that point, perhaps she does make some sort of an arrangement to limit her time as speaker. But look, the last time anybody tried to challenge her was 6 years ago after they lost control of the House in the 2010 elections. That was Heath Shuler, then a congressman from North Carolina. He only got 43 votes. So Tim Ryan is making a statement here. A lot of people expect him to move on, run for statewide office in Ohio. Some people even saying all this was just about giving higher profile to Tim Ryan to boost his prospects there in Ohio to be their next governor.
Well, what is the case that she makes for herself as why she is a good leader for the Democratic Party, even after so many election losses over the last few cycles?
That's right. Well, she is still seen as smart and tough. She is certainly experienced at holding together a highly diverse caucus. She represents the new Democratic caucus in the sense that that caucus consists primarily of people who are not white males, women, minorities, people who are both. And let's put in one more thing for Nancy Pelosi. She is a world-class fundraiser. She has really taken it to another level. Over the years she has been in the House leadership, she has raised over $500 million. For Democratic committees at all levels, $100 million in each of the last two election cycles. So losing elections, yes, but filling the coffers also.
Ron, of course, we're also watching the news from the Trump transition team. He says he has cut a deal with United Technologies to keep 1,000 jobs at Carrier that would have moved to Mexico. Let's listen here to Trump's pick for Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin talking on CNBC about that deal.
You can see that this started because the president-elect called up the CEO of United Technologies and said it's important to keep jobs here.
Do we know any of the specifics of this deal?
We know that the state of Indiana has made non-specified commitments to Carrier to help them make this make sense for them at the bottom line. Now, let's say about a half of the jobs that Carrier was going to move to Mexico are going to stay. They have committed to something like almost 1,000 of the previously announced 2,000. So we'll see how many jobs actually do move. But it's a lovely piece of PR triumph for the Trump-Pence ticket because Pence is, after all, the governor of Indiana,
right.
So he can still make representations on behalf of his state to the company. It's said to cost them about $65 million to keep these 1,000 jobs in Indiana. $65 million is not an awful lot when you're talking about state incentives. And let's also remember that of the $56 billion that United Technologies, the parent company of Carrier, has in its annual revenue, about a tenth of that, $5.6 billion, comes from the federal government. So doing something to please the new head of the federal government is probably not bad business for United Technologies and Carrier.
Well, that's the big question, too, is the president-elect going to do this with every company that threatens to take jobs out of the country? Are we going to be able to afford to, you know, offer those kinds of incentives every time?
Well, he only has one vice president, so he only has Mike Pence to do this for companies in Indiana. But surely he will get on the telephone. He has done this with Ford. He has done this with other people. And then he immediately takes credit for whatever decision is made thereafter, whatever the actual incentives may be for that decision. But he will certainly try to jawbone, as we used to say. We used to talk about presidents calling up corporate leaders and trying to jawbone with them to persuade them to lower prices on steel or to lower prices on other basic commodities. We haven't seen too much of that in recent years. If Democrats try to do it, they're usually told that they shouldn't interfere with the operation of the free market. But this is a president who's going to be hands-on, and we'll see if we have a lot of carriers or if this particular situation is unique.
And Ron, in just the minute we have left, when people hear headlines today about Donald Trump saying that he is going to take himself out of business operations of the Trump Organization completely, that's something he tweeted today, is that for real?
It's a little hard to imagine Walt Disney taking himself out of the entire Disneyland and Disney World operation. Sometimes a name is just synonymous with a business. So if he does sign documents, as he says he is going to do, that take him out completely from his business, does that mean then it's run by his children? Would that be a blind trust for Donald Trump? This is new territory. We're going to have to see what the documents say. We're going to have to see what legal experts say. And we're going to have to ultimately ask the people, are you satisfied with the degree to which the president is separating himself from his business?
That's NPR senior Washington editor and correspondent Ron Elving. Ron, thanks as always.
Thank you, Jim.
Well, staying with politics, for a generation, the West Coast has been the country's epicenter of progressives. In California, Oregon, Washington, the left-leaning, largely urban voting bloc has long dominated elections and handed victories to Democrats. But today, many progressive leaders are concerned that a Trump administration could pop this long-standing liberal bubble. Conrad Wilson from Here and Now contributor Oregon Public Broadcasting reports.
On election day in most of the country, Republicans won big up and down the ballot. But voters along the West Coast largely doubled down on progressive policies and candidates. Washington voters decided to increase the minimum wage. California joined the rest of the Pacific Northwest in legalizing recreational marijuana. And Oregon elected Democrat Kate Brown, the first openly bisexual governor in the country.
From a state perspective, it was a good night, but nationally, really a crazy night.
Oregon Speaker Tina Kotek is a Democrat and several years ago became the first openly gay woman in the country to lead a statehouse. Under a Trump administration, Kotek expects a resurgence of state control and innovation at the local level. And she says the relationship between these West Coast states will deepen during Trump's presidency.
The change for Oregon, and probably true for California and Washington, is now we are those states in the nation that are going to be doing things differently.
The incoming Trump administration appears to be gearing up for a showdown over immigration with states. President-elect Trump campaigned on cutting federal funding for communities that refuse to cooperate with federal immigration officers.
We will end the sanctuary cities that have resulted in so many needless deaths.
The West Coast is dotted with sanctuary cities. Since the election, leaders in Portland, Seattle, San Francisco, and other cities have said that regardless of the consequences, they'll protect immigrants. Portland Mayor-elect Ted Wheeler says he's asked immigration attorneys to see if there's anything that can be done to strengthen the safeguards already in place. Los Angeles Police Chief Charlie Beck told Southern California Public Radio it's up to the federal government to enforce its immigration laws.
Immigration is not the job of local law enforcement, immigration enforcement, that it is the job of the federal government, and they should do their job, and they should not rely on me to do it for them.
Clearly, the hope among many West Coast progressives is that the federal government will continue to leave them alone. Todd Donovan, a political science professor at Western Washington University, says the fear is that the Trump administration won't.
How much will they let Seattle and Portland and San Francisco continue to pursue those sort of progressive local policies? Or how much are they going to kind of try to come in and use the weight of the federal government to stop that, whether it's, you know, trying to get local law enforcement to be asking for documentation, or whether it's, you know, what will the Trump administration do with legal marijuana? Those are all up in the air right now.
For some, looking at the West Coast as one big progressive region fully opposed to Trump is an oversimplification.
Washington State is not blue. There's one big blue dot of which 80% of the rest of the state is red. Oregon's the same way.
Matt Manweller is a Republican member of the Washington House and teaches political science and constitutional law at Central Washington University. Manweller says some good has come out of this divisive election cycle.
I have had more liberal Democrats come to me and say, talk to me about your world. I obviously don't walk in it, and I don't understand it. And that has actually started some very powerful conversations that could lead to some form of compromise.
After the election, President Obama called on people to give Trump a chance to govern. But in cities along the West Coast, fears of what's to come have led to an unceasing series of protests about what Trump's election means for one of the most consistently progressive parts of the country. For Here and Now, I'm Conrad Wilson in Portland.
It's Here and Now. Recently, we rode an elevator up into the rarefied air of the fifth-floor Central Park South studio of Tony Bennett. We were greeted by Tony's assistant and the man himself.
Thank you very much. Come on inside.
Yeah, well, here we are.
The large studio apartment is filled with Tony's acclaimed paintings on walls and easels. We'll have pictures at hereandnow.org. Through the huge front windows, New York's Central Park stretches away.
The whole park. I live next door.
Right.
And this is my studio.
What a view. What a view. I can see some of your paintings out the window.
Yeah, right, right. Oh, yeah. And that's Manhattan. Is Katie Lang.
We look through a coffee table book of his artwork, his hand moving a little slower than our last visit. I'll be speaking a little louder, but at 90, Tony Bennett's got a new album, and it's called Tony Bennett Celebrates 90.
I got rhythm, I got music, I got my gal, who could ask for anything more? I got daisies in green pastures. I got my gal who could ask for anything more. Old man Trump.
And we've come to talk about his new memoir, written with NPR's Scott Simon. Tony Bennett, Just Getting Started. It's an homage to the people who've inspired his remarkable journey from Queens, New York, to citizen of the world.
I was so struck by the details. We learned that Pearl Bailey slugged the chorus girl, knocked her out on the stage.
She was making, trying to ruin the routine that she was doing on the stage, and she was heckling her from behind. You know, jealousy of playing with a big star like Pearl.
She slugged her?
Yeah, she just turned around and knocked her right out.
Nat King Cole was attacked by white supremacists on stage in Alabama.
It's tragic. You know, I'm so against any kind of prejudice, and he was such a beautiful man. In fact, he never recovered from that. When he went down, his back hit the back of the stage, and he was sick for the rest of his life. It was a very terrible situation.
So were others that you relate. I mean, you talk about how many African-American idols, how many blacks you worked with, couldn't go with you to, like, local restaurants when you were touring.
Oh, yeah. Well, Rosemary Clooney and I, we went to see a black artist in Washington, D.C., and after the show was over, we said, let's go backstage and congratulate the artist. And they said, well, you can't go backstage. He has to come out here to see you. And we were so angered. It's complete ignorance.
Well, it's interesting how much race figures into your book. I knew that Harry Belafonte had asked you to come to the Selma March to support King. I had no idea there was a volunteer who drove you around.
That's right.
A white woman.
That's right.
After having
had five children.
She had five children. You leave. What happens to her the next day?
She was shot. Complete ignorance, you know.
I mean, it was just awful. She was pursued by members of the KKK in her car. They shot and killed her. You were in that car the day before.
Right. No, it's complete ignorance, you know. We all belong here. It's better than any other country in the world, you know.
I left my heart in San Francisco. High on a hill, it calls to me.
By the way, Tony's driver, the white mother of five killed by the KKK, was Viola Luiso. This book is about her, Frank Sinatra, Lady Gaga. Then there's Sadie Vimmerstedt, who wrote some words on a napkin. She mailed it to Johnny Mercer, songwriter, Los Angeles. Right. And he got it.
She wrote, "I want to be around to pick up the pieces when somebody breaks your heart." And he liked it so much that he wrote the whole song for her.
I want to be around to pick up the pieces when somebody breaks your heart.
If you're of a certain generation, you can't hear early Tony Bennett without thinking of your parents. Nighttime would come and you'd hear Tony Bennett, you know, singing "Because of You" on the stereo. You'd know all was well.
Because of you, there's a song in my heart. Because of you, my romance had its start.
For many of us, it's some of the sweetest memories that we have.
Well, you know, I want to tell you something that I don't think anybody knows this, but I'm telling you that what's phenomenal about my career is that I've never had an empty seat in all the times I've been performing. To this day, I'm sold out, and now because I'm 90, they give me 6 standing ovations a night.
What do you think it is?
Talent. I know that sounds conceited, but it's just knowing what not to do. When I first started out, some great performers like George Burns and Jack Benny met me, and I had the 2 biggest records in the country with "Because of You" and "Cold, Cold Heart."
I tried so hard, my dear, to show that you're my every dream. Yet you're afraid each thing I do is just some evil scheme. A memory from your lonesome past keeps us so far apart. Why can't I free your doubtful mind and melt your cold, cold heart?
I was thrilled. I couldn't believe it. Jack Benny and George Burns. And they said, "Now you're doing great, kid, but you know what? It's going to take you quite a while to really learn what not to do." And funny enough, they were very accurate. It really took about 7 years to learn not to do too much on the stage, knowing when to get off, putting a little sense of humor into your show. And it really took 7 years to learn what not to do. I'm 90 years old, so it is a little sad when you realize a lot of great friends are gone and that I had beautiful days with when they were alive. Hopefully, if I get lucky enough, I could really live a lot longer. I'd like to live to about 105.
Oh, all I derive out of being alive, da-da-da, da-da-da, to 105.
I don't know. Have a head start if you are among the very young at heart.
Amy Winehouse, left so young.
I know. When I saw and heard that she was in trouble, I was going to tell her to try and slow down, that it's you could get hurt if you drink too much. When I got to the studio expecting to see her, my son, who manages me, Danny, came up to me and said, "We just found out she just died." I just started crying.
You know I'm yours for just the taking. I got me so
myself to you, body and soul.
She was a very exceptional talent. She knew how to do it.
You say you blame yourself that you wished you'd said something, but in your long career, you know you probably can't stop someone. You know, they have to stop themselves.
Yeah, that's right. I had to stop myself. I went a little far out when I was younger, and I realized I'm cheating the audience.
You know, you dabbled in cocaine, but yeah, you stopped
it. Stopped. There's one moment where I just stopped.
Just in time, I found you just in time. Before you came, my time was running low.
Do you ever sit back and think, how did this happen? You know, I was a kid from Astoria. Your mom sewed garments. Your dad died so young.
It happened because of my family. When my father died, I was 10 years old. So all my relatives, every weekend, they were all workers and we were very poor. And they would come over. And it was just a moment in my life at 10 years old when I just said, who am I? Is anybody ever going to know who I am? I was wondering who I was. But it was my relatives that told me who I was. They said, you're a singer and you're a painter. And boy, that did it. Because I said, that's who I am. Here I am, 90, but I feel like I'm just starting out because there's still so much to learn.
Oh, the good life, full of fun, seems to be the ideal.
Tony Bennett's new memoir, written with NPR's Scott Simon, is just getting started. His new album, Tony Bennett Celebrates 90, will be released mid-December. By the way, the Young at Heart duet we played was with the great Regina Stella. For pictures of our visit to his New York studio, go to herenow.org.
OPEC reached a deal today to cut oil production by more than a million barrels a day. The president of OPEC, Dr. Mohammed bin Salah Al Sada of Qatar, announced the agreement at OPEC's meeting in Vienna.
This agreement is out of the sense of responsibility for the general well-being and the health of world economy.
The cut in production is aimed at increasing oil prices around the world, and it appears to have done just that. Brent crude surging today. Maggie Lake hosts CNN Money with Maggie Lake. She joins us from New York. Hi, Maggie.
Hey, Jeremy.
And tell us more about this deal to cut production.
Yeah, the goal really is to try to take what has been record supply off the market and drive up oil prices, or at least try to really stabilize them above $50 a barrel. And I know we're probably hearing groans from all the drivers out there who have been loving this era of cheap gas, but it is sorely needed by these oil-producing nations who've seen their main source of income really cut by more than half, and that has become, in some cases, a really destabilizing effect or impact on their economy and ultimately probably isn't great for the world economy. So this is an attempt by OPEC to sort of at least put a strong floor under oil prices.
But OPEC had held back on cutting production for years now, yeah, in part because they wanted to drive down prices so that some of the U.S. producers, for example, would get out of the business. So why now?
Yeah, and it was a calculated plan. They were risking their own sort of economic pain to try to play a game of chicken, and they seem to have thrown in the towel. Basically, the economic fallout has become so severe that they were not only pulling back from that strategy in the case of Saudi Arabia, but I think overcoming what are really deep, deep political difficulties and divides within the own group. But you're looking at countries, rich oil countries, who've had budget deficits for the first time. They've had to introduce austerity. They've cut fuel subsidies. These are deeply unpopular measures with their own people that move them to the table and allow them to get over. I think they also realized their credibility was on the line. A lot of people were wondering if OPEC even mattered anymore. So that got them to the table. But the big sticking point today was really allowing Iran to continue to get a sort of, exemption, continue to increase production because it's trying to recover from the sanctions period. So that was the sticking point this time.
Maggie, I want to ask you about one more thing before we let you go, and that is the news from the Trump transition team that Steven Mnuchin is the choice for Treasury Secretary, and billionaire investor Wilbur Ross for Secretary of Commerce. Mnuchin, formerly of Goldman Sachs. How's Wall Street reacting to this news?
Oh, they are loving it, Jeremy. They really are. These are two business people, one of their own. They're very familiar with the way business is run and markets. They've done well for themselves. And they're talking today, their priority, tax reform, doing away with onerous regulation, boosting the economy, infrastructure spending, renegotiating trade. The trade part may be a little problematic, but all the rest of it is good news for business. And you are seeing that reflected. Stocks continue that record run. So they are very comfortable with this. And frankly, a lot of them like the fact that they haven't served in government before, thinking maybe this will usher in a new era of sort of a fresh voice and a more business-friendly reach out from Washington to the rest of the community.
So happiness on Wall Street. We'll have to see what the reaction is on Main Street.
Yes, exactly.
But, Maggie Lake, who hosts CNN Money with Maggie Lake. Thanks so much, as always.
Thanks for having me.
And it's time for our annual check-in to see which new words have been added this year to the American Heritage Dictionary of the English Language. It's fun to see how quickly these words become part of our vocabulary. 10 years ago, they added the terms red and blue state. They also added the cocktail mojito and the number puzzle Sudoku. So joining us, as he does every year, with this year's ads, Steve Kleinedler, executive editor of the American Heritage Dictionary. Steve, welcome back.
Thank you so much for having me back, Robin.
And we know you added over 400 new words and senses this year. What's the difference? What's a sense? I know one of them, for instance, the senses is journal.
Yes, a new word is precisely that, a word that we've added as an entry to the dictionary for the first time. A sense would be a definition of an existing term, but a new sense to go along with it. And as you mentioned, we added a verb sense for the word journal, the act of writing one's thoughts or observations in a journal. So you can journal, people do journaling, that kind of thing.
People hate when words become verbs like that, but into the dictionary it goes.
It happens all the time. I mean, people used to hate it when that happened with contact, when contact first became a verb back in the 50s and 60s. It drove people nuts. Oh, yeah. If you look in the first editions, you'll see these usage notes just talking about how much it drives people nuts, and it's become totally accepted.
So contact was somebody that was your contact?
Yes.
But then to contact someone was new?
Yes. And it was, you know, the suggestion was you should say whether you're going to write or call or telegram or whatever.
So let that be a cautionary tale. I mean, things that you don't like now are going to be, people are going to say it's old hat in 50 years.
Absolutely.
So how does it happen? How does a word get in?
It depends on the type of word. For example, the four new chemical elements that they isolated this summer, once they get finalized in December, they'll go in next year because the scientists in charge of them say, hey, this element that we're calling oganesson, that's its name, and it goes. Usually it's not that cut and dried. A lot of times we're looking at a variety of source material from across the country in different styles of newspapers, blogs, you name it. And when it's got a wide currency and we think it's going to stick around for a while, because we don't tend to put in things that we think are going to fall out of use in a year or two. The more currency it has, the more staying power it has. And when the meaning is kind of settled, that's a time that we're most likely to add it.
Well, one of those this year, Zika.
Yes. Yeah. That's a good example of something that might not need to stay around as long before we'd consider putting it in. Much like we added norovirus or Marburg virus in years past, this became such a large health threat that it was deemed to go in.
If somebody wants to know what it is, you want to have the information there. Ransomware, something you'd not even heard of 10 years ago.
Right. 10 years ago, you might have heard of it in a futuristic cyberpunk novel. But now it's a very common occurrence, something that disables the operation of your computer until you pay money or some other ransom to the organization responsible for it.
Yeah. Okay. So that's, an unfortunate addition. But some fun terms. Glamping, glamorous camping?
Yes. It was when this first came to my attention, I was thinking, how big a word can this possibly be? It is everywhere. You see countless, everything from newspaper articles to Pinterest sites. Not only is it a huge field, it's commercially, you get people marketing for people who want to go to sell products to them, that kind of thing. It's quite a force.
Okay, if your smartphone or your tablet isn't working, it's a brick. It's not connecting to the internet. That goes in.
Yep.
But talk about another just kind of change in usage. A big one this year, the word they, with a singular antecedent.
Right. The singular use of they, as in everyone took their hat and left, has been around in the English language for centuries, even though people have railed against it.
And why would they rail against it? Because...
Well, the traditional grammar rule that we were trained in elementary school is that the generic form is he. Everyone took his hat and left. Or you could say everyone took his or her hat and left. But I think most editors would agree that his or her is clunky. They is very naturally what people use. It's been part of the language for quite some time. So we surveyed our usage panel last year. And depending on the type of sentence, up to half of the usage panel found it acceptable, which is a vast increase from years past. The usage note, which can be found at ahdictionary.com, search on the word they. There's a fairly lengthy usage note there that gives the history.
This would be even more important now when there is so much gender bending.
Well, that's a secondary use, is that for people who are gender fluid or don't conform to the gender binary, you'll see individuals who wish to refer to themselves as they. And that was another usage that we polled. And what was interesting, about a quarter of the panelists accepted it. And among the panelists born after 1945, 40% did. And that's a pretty remarkable shift in a short period of time.
Right. What words didn't make the cut?
Well, I've got a couple of words that didn't make it this year, but will be in next year. Two of them you might find interesting. One is self-care, the activities you undertake and the things that you do to make sure that you're not burning yourself out. That is very likely to go in early next year. Another word, a common compound, we didn't have time to get in this year, but it will probably go in next year, is down ballot as an adjective, like down ballot races.
Oh, yeah, that's a good one. Well, we know, Steve, that the American Heritage Dictionary never picks a word of the year. You add words because of their usage. But the dictionary.com word of 2016 is one that has a usage note in your dictionary this year. It is Xenophobia, and I spell it because, how do you pronounce it?
There's actually two acceptable pronunciations, and that's what we were testing, xenophobia and xenophobia. Xenophobia is the older pronunciation, but xenophobia has been around for quite a while. And last year when we surveyed the usage panel, the panel overwhelmingly found both forms to be acceptable, and slightly more at 55% preferred the xenophobia pronunciation.
Xenophobia, xenophobia, fear of foreigners. Kind of sad that that is the word of the year.
It is. It really is.
Leave us on a happier note. What's a goofy word?
A goofy word. I like food. So we can talk about some of the food words. For example, poke, which is spelled P-O-K-E, which is a Hawaiian salad or appetizer consisting of raw fish, usually tuna, served in soy sauce and sesame oil. I wonder if I'm getting you hungry now. Another word I was surprised we didn't already have, but was Spätzle, the German pasta or dumpling.
Spätzle's just going in the dictionary?
I know that it's one of those words. I think our food editor was doing a pasta review or something, and we noticed it, for whatever reason, had never been put in. So that's another, a good function of the editors. You know, when you're researching specific areas, sometimes you find these gaps that were there and you didn't realize it until you looked at it closely. So, you know, in addition to looking at new stuff, we do regular reviews of subject areas for this very reason.
Yeah. Swaths of the country are so relieved that their Spätzle is now in your dictionary. Words that have been added to the American Heritage Dictionary. We'll have a list at hereandnow.org. Steve Kleinedler, executive editor of the American Heritage Dictionaries, always visits with us at the end of year to let us know what's new and, as we just heard, what's old. Steve, thanks.
Thank you so much, Robin, for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Well, climate change was once a new phrase. Now it's very much a part of the conversation, but it still can be hard to wrap your brain around it. But atmospheric scientists at the University of Washington have made it possible to listen to the planet changing. John Ryan from Here and Now contributor KUOW has more from Seattle.
If you're like most people, you've probably never heard of the Keeling curve. It traces how much carbon dioxide is in the sky. Scientists have been watching it curve upward since the 1950s. Here's what it sounds like. Graduate student Judy Tweet and Professor Dargan Frierson converted half a century of data into about a minute of sound. Each CO2 measurement got a different pitch.
Lower notes correspond with lower carbon dioxide concentrations. You can hear there's a natural up and down.
As plants breathe in CO2 each summer and breathe it out each winter, the pitch rises and falls. And as pollution adds more CO2, the whole cycle keeps rising, taking the Earth's temperature up with it. Frierson is a scientist and a musician, so he added drums.
I think everything should have a drum track. Everything would sound better. You know, the hope is that more people would listen to it, potentially, if it's a little bit fun.
University of Washington scientists have been trying unscientific methods to get people to pay attention. They're making climate video games and even detective shows. 50 climate scientists at the university have stepped into the political arena. This year, they endorsed a carbon tax on the Washington ballot. Voters this month rejected what would have been the nation's first carbon tax.
I am a scientist, but I'm also a citizen of the world. I have a daughter who's going to be experiencing a different climate because of the rise of CO2.
Whether the song makes you want to dance or march in the streets, Frierson says hearing climate change unfold can help it sink in more than just seeing it on a graph. For Here and Now, I'm John Ryan in Seattle.
South Korea is in the midst of a political crisis after President Park Geun-hye offered this week to resign if parliament comes up with a plan to transfer power. It's her latest attempt to fend off impeachment and stop massive street protests amid claims she allowed a longtime friend to influence her political decisions for personal gain. Joining us now from Seoul is the BBC's Steve Evans. And Steve, first off, it seems pretty likely at this point that the president is going to be leaving office. Is it a done deal?
Not quite. It's never done till it's done. But if you look at all the metrics, her approval rating goes down to 5%, and you think it can't get any lower, then it goes down to 4%. Every Saturday now, for the last five Saturdays, there have been hundreds of thousands of people on the streets here in Seoul demonstrating, chanting that she must go. So it looks very, very likely that the assembly, the National Assembly, will try and impeach her. But you can never be sure until the deed is done.
And remind us, for people who haven't been following this closely, what this is all about, why she is in such trouble.
It's about old-fashioned corruption, which has dogged every single president of South Korea in the democratic era, which only lasts for the last 30 years. She's got an old friend, a friend of 40 years standing, who she clearly relies on. And the accusation, the formal accusation, is that the friend controlled two funds and went to the biggest companies in Korea, Samsung Down, and said to these companies, "I'm a friend of the president. If you want influence, you need to give some millions of dollars to these funds." And that would be kind of okay for the president, except the prosecutor thinks that she knew about it, was complicit in the whole thing. The president can't be prosecuted when she's still the president. The moment she ceases being president, the likelihood is that she will be, she'll find herself in front of a court and maybe end up behind bars.
So what would a transfer of power look like? Who's in line to replace her?
It'll be the prime minister. The way these things work is that once the impeachment proceedings start, she's removed from power. She's technically still the president, but she has no say in anything. And remember, North Korea is a matter of 100 miles away. So there are big things to worry about. She steps aside while the National Assembly debates the thing and tries to get the vote. And just like in the US, they would need two-thirds majority to actually fire her, to say it's all over. And it would then go to the Constitutional Court, in effect the Supreme Court, and six of those nine judges would have to say the same. What gives this thing added spice is that the old friend is the daughter of a man who was close to President Park's father, a previous president, and who set up his own cult. So there are all kinds of rumors of weird cult rituals going on in the Blue House, as they call the White House, the presidential palace. A week ago, it was revealed that somebody in the presidential office bought Viagra. And you kind of think, what on earth is going on here? The president's a woman, apart from anything, but it's a bit bizarre. They then said, no, it was because we were traveling to countries with very high altitude capitals, and Viagra apparently is an antidote to altitude sickness. So there are all these sort of bizarre side aspects to it. But the nub, the central allegation, it's old-fashioned money corruption.
Well, that took a turn I was not expecting, Steve. But Well, let me just ask you one more thing, which is, how does this affect the region, the United States? This is obviously a very important country and a lot going on in that region right now.
Well, we don't know what the relationship with the United States is going to be. Donald Trump, soon to be President Trump, was pretty scathing about the relationship when he was running for office. So we don't know what the relationship is going to be anyway. If you then have a power vacuum as this new relationship is formed, that's a difficulty. On top of that, Kim Jong-un is there, and Kim Jong-un is developing nuclear weapons with the stated aim of being able to hit the United States. Now, those functioning nuclear weapons and the missiles and the warheads are probably about 4 or 5 years away, but we're getting to make your mind up time on this. What is the US going to do about it? Kim Jong-un has already exploded 5 nuclear devices. It's widely thought that you can't take his nuclear plants out, his processing plants out, with attacks, because his conventional weapons are so massive that Seoul would be destroyed. So what's Donald Trump going to do about it? They don't know here. If you then have a power vacuum with that kind of uncertainty, it's a very difficult situation.
That's the BBC's Steve Evans joining us from Seoul, South Korea. Steve, thanks so much.
As ever, you're very welcome.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.